Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take AIM, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Roger.
So it looks like we've got another really interesting show today. We've got two guests that we're waiting for right now. The first one is going to be Mark Hemingway of the Washington Examiner, and he is going to be talking about a story that he co-authored about these bogus jobs that have been discovered that based on the stimulus package and some of them coming from congressional districts that don't even exist. It's really quite an amazing story, huh?
It definitely is. It's been getting some pickup in the media, which is good.
And then in the second half hour, we got Andy McCarthy, our first return guest, who is going to be talking about the recent decision by the Obama administration and Eric Holder, the Attorney General, to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other alleged terrorists related to 9/11 terrorist activity and bring them to New York to try them in federal court, in civilian court, rather than before a military tribunal as was moving along, in which actually they had Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had confessed, had requested that he be executed, and it seemed to be in a pretty good place as far as getting justice. Now it's going to have to start all over, and with a whole different set of rules of evidence, and he can certainly claim that he was tortured, and we will be getting into all that in the second half hour. But here shortly, hopefully we're going to have Mark Hemingway on the line. Let's talk a little about the Washington Examiner. Is a paper that's been here in D.C. now for, what, I'm guessing about 2 years or so. And right now there's been a lot of turmoil at the Washington Times with the editor and the editorial page editor and other top executives leaving, some being fired, some being asked to leave, some leaving on their own, and it's really in turmoil following, I guess, the Reverend Moon passing the baton to one of his sons, and so there's a lot going on over there, and both of these sort of represent conservative newspapers in the Washington, D.C. area to go up against the powerful Washington Post. Any thoughts on your part, Don, about how this newspaper situation is going here?
Well, I think from my perspective at this point, I'm concerned about the future of the Times. This reorganization or shakeup is probably coming at the worst time for the paper. They were already suffering from a fairly large decline in their circulation, which wasn't that great to begin with, but they took a fairly big hit. So they're suffering on that one end. The last thing I think you need is a management shakeup when there were initiatives that were being put forth by John Solomon. Admittedly, Solomon wasn't necessarily known as a rabid conservative or anything like that, but in talking with people around town, on the conservative side, they seem to think that Solomon was at least headed in the right direction with the things that he was doing, creating the conservatives.com website and trying to open things up more. They started a kind of a radio program that they did for the newspaper. So there were things that were, I think, keeping them on the map or putting them on the map in a different way and opening them up to more people. And now it's kind of questionable as to what happens to those initiatives, as well as, you know, who's really going to be running the paper here in the future.
Okay, Don, well, Mark Hemingway has joined us on the line, and I'm going to turn this over to you and go ahead and take it away, and I'll be back at about halfway through, so go ahead.
All right. Well, we are joined today by Mark Hemingway. Mark Hemingway is a commentary writer at the Washington Examiner and was previously a staff reporter with National Review Online. You can find him on Twitter as Heminator. I just want to let you know I followed you after I got this information. He created the Examiner's map of what was then 75,343,000 bogus jobs created or saved by the stimulus, along with David Ferdosa. I believe that figure is now up to 80,000.
I know Dave was adding some extra jobs yesterday.
An update from Charlie about
that.
But Mark, welcome to Take Aim.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this. Tell me a little more about the Examiner. You know, how it was established, what you guys are doing, what's the outlook?
Well, the outlook for the Examiner is actually great. We are a Metro Daily in Washington, D.C. We've been around for 4 or 5 years. We're primarily a commuter paper. We're a tabloid, we're not a sensational paper in the tabloid sense. We're very much focused on local coverage, and we're also, you know, because we are in D.C., also focused editorially and politically on national politics, and I don't know what to say other than if you're ever in D.C., pick it up or read us at WashingtonExaminer.com. We have a great, you know, conservative editorial page and some, you know, just fantastic news coverage of the Washington, D.C. area. Things are doing great.
Well, that's good. Would you consider the paper then, you know, more oriented towards conservative politics?
The paper's owned by Phil Anschutz, who is, well-known in conservative circles and, definitely editorially has a conservative focus. But bear in mind, like a good newspaper, the newsroom is not, you know, influenced by, you know, what necessarily the political focus of the editorial page or the owner is. I think we try and bring, you know, sort of, you know, secular journalism values and tough reporting. And marry that with, you know, an outlet for conservative opinion on the editorial pages. We have a number of high-profile conservative columnists who you might be more familiar with, like Byron York and Michael Barone, have both started working for the paper this year. And it's an interesting experiment. We're a major Metro Daily competing with the Washington Post, and, we've got 50 people in the newsroom. You know, we're a lean, mean news operation where we're pretty hungry to break news and, fill the vacuum where, you know, the Post, you know, political blind spots on local politics and national politics exist.
So speaking of breaking news, let's talk about the Obama administration has been claiming that their $787 billion economic stimulus package saved or created about 650,000 jobs. The problem for them is that they were seeming to go to great lengths to document the jobs. David Ferdosa at the Examiner were among a few of the enterprising journalists who decided to examine that evidence for their claims. Tell me how you got into the story and what you found.
Well, basically what happened was is we had done a series of posts on our blog at the Examiner, our opinion blog called Beltway Confidential. And what we had done is we've been noting that there were all these news reports all over the country from, you know, local newspapers, newspapers in Milwaukee and Chicago and other places that were pointing out that a lot of these stimulus jobs that when they call the agencies that have gotten the grants or whatever and tried to see, you know, account for how many jobs actually been created, that the people couldn't do it. And we realized there was once we'd compiled reports from, like, you know, dozens of different states or whatever, that, clearly the numbers were greatly, greatly inflated. So we thought, well, you know what? What if we compiled all these news reports into, like, one source, and we did some, checking things against the recovery.gov website where the White House is claiming to track all this stuff, and we put it all on a map for people to look at. And what we found is that some, 75,000 now, or I guess it's now above 75,000 jobs, which is, well more than 10% of the jobs that the administration is claiming the stimulus created, either simply did not exist or could not be reliably accounted for. I would point out that this is separate from the 60,000 jobs that the White House said that they purged from their count, and this is also separate from the jobs that were allegedly created in phantom congressional districts. So, I mean, we've done some, fairly comprehensive, research, and based on local, news accounts that no one has really questioned, it sure looks like a huge, huge percentage of the stimulus jobs, don't exist or can't be accounted for. And bear in mind that this is also just, from a number of isolated pre-existing news reports. It's not like we went out and dug up this information ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of states where no news outlets or news affiliates have even, done any digging into their state's, stimulus job numbers. So, I mean, for all we know, it's it could be much, much higher than the 10% or more of jobs that we found.
Well, what about that GAO report? I mean, I think it was 58,000 jobs. There's no money was spent, but they created 58,000 jobs. I mean, how does that come about?
Well, part of it is simply that, I don't know. The administration's defense has been that, they're not responsible for, how people report the data, which is, I understand that, you're giving out, thousands of grants and you can't be responsible for verifying, each individual grant as it comes in. But at the same time, they're taking political credit for creating all these jobs that they are, being defensive about whether or not they should be, accountable for verifying whether or not the jobs exist. So, they really can't have it both ways. Clearly we've seen a tremendous amount of stakes, and clearly they're all in one direction of inflating these stimulus job totals. So, I think we can determine that there is a fair amount of political pressure for the White House to make this, stimulus look like a much bigger success than it has been. So, it's a situation where I don't think it looks favorable for the White House any way you want to slice it, and frankly, the defenses of what's going on don't really hold water.
And I think that leads into, if you've seen Jonathan Carl's reports on ABC News over the last couple of days,
mm-hmm.
when he was reporting on Monday about this issue, he basically said, in contacting the White House, that yes, there were errors, but we
mm-hmm.
should stand by the jobs numbers. And then the next day he goes and he approaches the districts that actually do exist and finds some more problems there where there are, as you refer to, bogus jobs. And so now the White House looks like they're backing off a little bit, but still not completely. I definitely agree that I think this has become a very big political thing for them, but they're going to be extremely embarrassed.
They promised
to fix this by Friday, I thought, too.
Yeah. Well, politically, they can't back off. I mean, they were, stuck in a situation where they wanted to spend $787 billion or whatever in this, stimulus plan that was, clearly ill thought out. Remember the phrase timely, temporary, and targeted? The only reason why, from an economic perspective that the stimulus was supposed to work is if, a lot of money was doled out very quickly. And, what we've seen is a small percentage of the stimulus money has, trickled out, and it's rife with fraud and, the general kind of, corruption and malfeasance and just general incompetence that you would expect when, the government undertakes a project of this size. So they were doing that, but politically it was untenable for them to, dole out this kind of money without having some sort of, accountability metrics in place. And the recovery.gov stuff was, has been both a blessing and a curse. They needed something to hold this, big project of theirs accountable, to make it, palatable politically. But at the same time, the more that they, the public understands, what's actually going on, the worse it looks for them. And the crazy thing about all this is that if you've ever been to recovery.gov, which is the White House website that's tracking where the stimulus money is, I mean, the darn thing, it looks very nice. They spent $18 million just creating a website. it looks very nice, and it looks like they're making a concerted effort or whatever to try and be transparent. The moment you actually try and use it, I mean, it's a nightmare. I mean, it's just not usable. It's very hard to pull the information you get. You can't sort anything by the conditions that you want. You can't search for anything individually in any way that's reliable. And it makes it very, very hard to actually hold the government accountable, which is why all of the data we got was from, you know, independent reporting, you know, and from, you know, local news organizations in, you know, in their states throughout the country, where, you know, people actually did the legwork and, you know, called up the individual grantees and you know, talked to the state agencies and stuff that were using grants. So that's really the only good reliable way to get a handle on it as of now. There are some people at the Mercatus Center and George Mason University and some other groups, recovery.org and things that they're doing their best to try and make the data more usable. But, you know, as of now, it's pretty clear that the White House would just as soon have you not know what is going on with that tax money that's being spent.
I went to that website the other day after watching the ABC report on Tuesday, looking to see, I wanted to get more information behind one of the numbers that they had posted on there. And I tell you, I couldn't figure out how they found that number. It must have taken a heck of a lot of legwork, or maybe it was someone else, you know, like you mentioned, that reported on it, because that website is just virtually impossible to use to get anything usable out of it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that strikes me too, though, is just, you know, with these examples, is just how crazy they are. For instance, a month-long roofing project that received less than $30,000 in stimulus funds involved 6 workers, but then was reported as creating 450 jobs. I mean,
mm-hmm.
What are some of the other blatant examples that you found?
This is terrible of me. I would have to pull up the map and take a look at it. But some of the bigger ones that popped out is there was a lot of jobs that were, you know, temporary, you know, even lasting, you know, only a few weeks or whatever. They were claiming that a new job was created, which, you know, obviously is not the point of the stimulus. You know, the point is to, you know, spur actual, you know, legitimate job growth. And the biggest examples we saw were like state agencies where they were doing things like, in Washington State, there were thousands and thousands of jobs, I think tens of thousands maybe, where what they had done was, they had, in order to offset state budget cuts, they had paid a bunch of teachers who were already contracted through the end of the year, you know, were not going to be fired in any way, shape, or form, with the stimulus funds, and then said that the stimulus had, you know, quote, saved or created all those jobs, which, you know, these people were already under contract. It's clear that they weren't saving or creating any jobs. So, and, you know, they were doing this on a mass scale. The same thing happened in California. The California university system basically claimed that you know, these stimulus funds, saved them from firing half their workforce in the California university system, which is obviously, you know, a huge number of employees. You know, the reality is when the Sacramento Bee called them up and they said, you know, were you really going to fire half your workforce? They said, well, no, you know, we weren't actually going to do that. They're pretty shameless for a lot of people about, you know, the numbers that they're reporting. You know, I don't know whether this is just through mistakes or like I said, you know, obviously since all these mistakes appear to be in the wrong direction in terms of inflating the stimulus numbers, you know, what kind of political pressures are being brought to bear to make the stimulus look like a success?
Well, one of the things that Jonathan Carl had reported on I thought was just amazing was Augusta, Georgia. I don't know if you saw that report or saw that story.
Mm-hmm.
317 jobs created, you know, as reported, but what that turned out to be, it was for a one-time raise for Head Start employees.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they called up the Head Start people, and the fiscal officer there said he was told that that was okay, but he was supposed to report when he called the helpline for recovery.gov.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so are they being that duplicitous? They're saying, oh, when you call up for assistance as how to report this and how to fill out this paperwork, they're telling you, yeah, report anything or just do that. I mean, a one-time pay raise. I mean, that was about $800,000. That's a mm-hmm. pretty good chunk of change.
Mm. Well, yeah, no, we've seen a lot of that. We've seen a number of cases where, like, you know, state agencies and stuff were, you know, claiming that we're giving people cost of living increases with stimulus funds and claiming that that was saving their jobs. Well, you know, it's, you know, clearly That's not the case. You know, I mean, I can't say. I mean, I haven't seen enough evidence to say that, you know, this is, you know, deliberately, you know, mendacious. You know, that there's an actual concerted attempt afoot, you know, to deliberately, you know, inflate these numbers. But at the same time, you know, and, you know, with the federal government is involved, you know, never underestimate, you know, the level of incompetence. You know, like I said, it looks awfully suspicious because all of these numbers, you know, all the mistakes seem to be made in one direction. We're not uncovering, you know, millions of mistakes where people failed to report jobs that they created.
Right.
And clearly the unemployment rate is rising.
Right, right. Yeah, but correct. And I was looking at watchdog.org, and one of the reports that I saw there today was just that they counted, I guess it came via New Mexico, there were 440, you know, non-existent districts, you know, that have reported in that they've received stimulus money to create the or save these jobs. I do agree that, you know, dealing with the federal government and paperwork and everything like that, it is a difficult task, but it does seem awfully suspicious that, you know, the magnitude of these errors seems to be beyond belief.
Yeah, no, and in some cases it literally is involving, you know, tens of thousands of jobs in one fell swoop. So yeah, I mean it's hard to say what's going on. I mean, I don't want to. I mean, I have no concrete evidence that anything is you know, anything that looks untoward is going on. But you know, it's just at some point, you know, logic tells you that it has to be. You know, so there has to be something going on there, and that something needs to be investigated. More by the press. I'm glad the ABC News is on the case, and certainly we're still working on crunching the stimulus data, and as are a number of, you know, good watchdog groups like, you know, the Mercatus Center and some other people that I mentioned. But you know, I really hope that, you know, people continue to, you know, really dig into the stuff. I mean, it's a gold mine of information. They put a lot of information out there. I mean, they're not going to help you use it, but I mean, there's still a lot to be done, and we still don't really have a good handle on how much stimulus money has been allocated by, you know, say, congressional district. We don't have a good handle on, like, say, how much stimulus money has been, you know, doled out in relation to the specific areas where unemployment is the worst. I mean, there's all kinds of metrics that the government should be interested in measuring this stuff by, but, you know, I think it's pretty clear that they're not interested in these things because the stimulus is not proving to be a success given what the unemployment rate is where it's at now, and politically it would look very bad for them if, you know, they were very honest about what was going on.
Well, one politician who's weighed in on this is David Obie, the Wisconsin Democrat and chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, and he said, when you cite the jobs created in congressional districts that don't exist, I think that strikes anyone from the White House on down as being more than stupid.
Yeah.
Yet, in my judgment, someone who doesn't know which congressional district they're in doesn't have enough of a clue to receive taxpayer money in the first place. What do you think about that?
Well, that I would like to hope that would be the case, but you know, I don't think that that rationale would necessarily fly with congressional Democrats. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing that astounds me about this is, and Obey seems to have his finger on the pulse more than most Democrats, is that I don't know if you saw that Joe Biden has publicly issued some statements where, you know, he's supposed to be the stimulus sheriff, remember? And Joe Biden has publicly issued some statement, you know, basically to the effect of, you know, move along, nothing to see here, there's a small number of jobs and we're fixing it. I think that, you know, when, you know, we're reporting that there are, you know, 2,000 fake jobs in the, you know, 47th congressional district of Fredonia, that, you know, he'd be interested in you know, correcting that and getting out in front of this before it blows up and becomes a bigger scandal. And you know, it's already a big deal. You know, most I think most people are paying attention to this, and you know, particularly people that are employed and you know, embittered about the certain that are the people that are unemployed and not doing well economically are paying attention to this stuff, and it looks really callous to not care about this. In fact, Congressman Daryl Issa of California wrote an op-ed making this point in the pages of the Washington Examiner recently, and I think Congressman Issa is right. I mean, it makes the Democrats look very, very out of touch, And they're making a big political mistake by ignoring these problems with the stimulus reporting.
Well, in your opinion, who is ultimately responsible for this? Who is supposed to take charge of this project anyway? We hear, you know, information from the White House. But who's running this thing? Who's responsible for all these errors?
Well, obviously it's the White House for no other reason than, you know, even though the congressional Democrats and everything passed this, and they should be held accountable to a certain degree. I mean, the White House is the one that, you know, set up the website that tracks this. They were the one that assured everyone that, you know, if we went through with this, you know, economic recovery plan, that they would be the ones that would be monitoring and policing this to make sure that, you know, the money went into the right hands and was, you know, effectively used. You know, Joe Biden was a stimulus sheriff. You know, the White House is the one running the website that's tracking all the data. So, I mean, I think it really has to be sort of, you know, laid at their doorstep. Although, you know, like I said, congressional Democrats certainly do bear their share of the blame. But for the time being, I think the White House should be the focal point.
Well, I thought it was interesting how this has just started to come up. And then I think the other day, the president, you know, made an announcement that, you know, he was going to make a concerted effort to stamp out government waste. He was referring to some other things, I think, initially, but this, I think, is maybe even a bigger problem. Was he trying to do something politically there too, as well, or what?
I'm sure that's it. I mean, you know, he spent a lot of money, and it's going to be a big issue in the next year. So, of course, you know, the Democratic Party and you know, is bleeding independents, and, you know, there are polls out recently that show the President Obama, who even as the Democrats were plummeting in the polls, you know, remained personally popular. Even their polls now that show the president's popularity under 50%. So, I mean, I think that they're worried about this. So they're trying to pivot somehow, and somehow after everything that's gone on this year, appear fiscally responsible, so they can, you know, stop bleeding independents so bad in the polls. I don't know how convincing they're going to be able to do that. I mean, it's hard to argue that, you know, they're handling the stimulus and fiscally responsible. There's nothing particularly fiscally responsible about healthcare, you know, even if you are, you know, morally in favor of what they're trying to do. So it's going to be very hard for them to make this point. And, you know, also remember that the president, you know, made, you know, noises or whatever about getting each department, each executive branch agency or whatever to cut into their budget when, you know, it was, you know, purely symbolic amounts of money. It was by no means, you know, a amounts of money that, you know, actually showed that the man is committed to fiscal conservatism, you know, like he promised in the campaign. And so, I mean, I think they're worried about this, but the funny thing is, like, they're worried about only about the political consequences. You know, I don't think that, and they're trying to get by on rhetoric and these issues alone. They're not doing anything to concretely address a lot of the things that are going on. I mean, it's one thing to make noises about how, you know, he's going to force Congress to tighten its belt or whatever, you know, but there's so many issues that are ongoing that they appear unconcerned with, you know, the fiscal responsibility of it, you know, case in point, you know, the stimulus, and that's something that should be laid right at the president's doorstep.
Now, I mentioned, obviously, these reports by Jonathan Carl of ABC, but beyond that, how has the rest of the mainstream media done on this this issue?
Well, you know, actually, this isn't, a lot of the national press has been very uninterested in covering this sort of stuff. It's a very sort of thankless story. I mean, you know, it requires a lot of, you know, digging into numbers and other things like that. So it's not the kind of thing that, you know, reporters in the New York Times and Washington Post, you know, like to do. It's grunt work, frankly, although I think it's very important journalism. And I'm, you know, happy and proud to have, you know, been involved in some of the work that I've done on it so far. That said, I mean, our investigation would not have been possible without fantastic work done by, you know, local newspapers all over the country. You know, unless you live in Milwaukee, you know, you don't read the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's website, most likely, but, you know, they did yeoman's work, you know, reporting on their state. You know, same with the Sacramento Bee, and a lot of other papers around the country did, you know, very, very good work on this. And if you go to our website and you look at the WashingtonExaminer.com and you look at our stimulus maps, you'll see that we credited each, you know, individual newspaper that did these reports and, you know, provided a link back to the original source. So, you know, in that sense, you know, journalism in this country and newspaper journalism does provide a very vital function on a regional level. It's just the national press and of the mainstream media that's gotten so distorted and out of whack that you know they're not interested in covering this stuff. But you know, when local newspapers bear down and cover what's going on in the backyard of the federal government, they tend to do a very good and very non-ideological job.
Now, we talked, you know, this bill or this website and everything, this has all been about job creation or jobs that have been saved. The president has announced that, excuse me, that he's planning on holding a job summit come up in, you know, in December.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to do? Is that going to really help the situation?
Yes, I'm sure it will do, you know, wonders to the situation. You know, every time the government calls for a summit or a panel or a blue ribbon commission, you know, you and I both know that, you know, lots of things, you know, lots of good things always emanate from that. I am a bit cynical, yes, about the prospect of that doing much for the unemployment rate. You know, bear in mind that the White House promised if this stimulus package were passed that unemployment would not rise above 8% and would be declined steadily since the middle of the summer. Well, here we are. I mean, the unemployment rate is way above where they said it would be even if the stimulus package wasn't passed. You know, that was, you know, what they told us in order for passing the stimulus bill. They made very specific promises about what employment would be like. I do not envy the president for having to respond to that, but, you know, people should hold him accountable for that. If you're going to, you know, spend that much taxpayer money and make that specific a promise, then you should very much be held accountable for it.
And, you know, we've talked about how the press has covered this a little bit and how Congress now seems to be getting more interested in this whole bogus jobs issue and things like that. Have you seen or been able to see any indication of how the public thinks what's going about this?
The stimulus?
Well, the reaction to the whole bogus jobs story.
Well, you know, I mean, I can only go based on my inbox and the popularity of our particular investigation. I can't remember the exact figures off the top of my head, but our little stimulus jobs map on the paper's website and our editorial highlighting it have gotten, I mean, just, you know, hits through the roof. You know, people are, I'm convinced, very, very interested in knowing about this stuff and very, very interested in, you know, seeing how the stimulus shakes out. And, you know, of course, I'm still getting emails every day from people that, you know, are suggesting, you know, things that we should, you know, investigate or, you know, are very pleased to see that someone is looking into this sort of thing. I think that the public is, you know, very much interested in what's going on, and they're very concerned about the fiscal picture of this country, which, you know, has not been helped by the stimulus. I think you'll see continued interest in the issue.
All right. What else are you working on besides this now? I mean, are you moving on, going to stay on this issue and then just move on to something else as well?
Well, I mean, you know, I work at the editorial page here, so it means that I handle just about everything under the sun, depending on what's needed. You know, we comment on various issues of the day, you know, whether it's, you know, assigning commentaries or, you know, little, you know, features or, you know, writing editorials outright on, you know, the news of the day. But that said, we are going to stay on the stimulus issue, and we're looking at other ways to analyze and present the data. We are a very small newsroom for a major metro daily. I think we only have 51 people in the newsroom. But by contrast, the Washington Post acts like the sky is falling because their newsroom's gone from 1,000 to 650 reporters. The New York Times has two people, you know, on staff full time to do nothing but quote unquote data visualization. Anything we do along these lines is, you know, purely through our own, you know, initiative and hard work, you know, and time that we don't have a lot to spare. So we are looking to, you know, coordinate maybe with some other watchdog groups and otherwise find ways to, you know, analyze and crunch the stimulus data. You know, we're talking about trying to find ways to, you know, look at stimulus data, you know, and how it's being allocated by congressional district, how it's being allocated in relation to unemployment. And there's a bunch of other factors that you can do, and we're trying to find ways to crunch the data and present it right now, because I know that based on our previous report, there's a lot of interest in it.
Well, great, Mark. Our other guest is on the line, so we have to scoot along here. But I really
is that Andy McCarthy?
Yeah, that is. And
hi.
Tell Andy I said hello.
There you go.
Andy right here.
Oh, hey, Andy. It's Mark Hemingway. How are you doing?
I'm sorry?
It's Mark Hemingway. How are you doing?
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing great. You were doing yeoman's work on the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed stuff.
Well, you're very nice to the neighborhood polemicist. I appreciate it.
All right, well, good luck. I'll let you have your time on the radio show. And thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you later. Bye.
Well, thanks, Don and Mark. That was a great interview. And, yes, Andy, welcome back to Take Aim.
That's
happy
right.
to have
How
you back
you?
On. Great. Yeah, Andy is our first guest who is a return guest. He was on one of our early shows and then recently spoke at AIM's 40th anniversary conference, which you can still see on C-SPAN. If you were receiving our daily emails, you would have received that link. And anyway, but we've got so much to cover. Let me quickly get into it with the decision announced last week to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four other Gitmo detainees to federal court to be tried for their involvement in the terrorist act of 9/11, I could think of no one better to talk about this than our guest today, Andy McCarthy. For years, Andy was fighting radical Islam in the only arena it was really being fought, namely the courtrooms. He prosecuted the blind sheikh and others for their involvement in the first World Trade Center bombing, which took place in 1993. And later he worked at the Defense Department, and now he's with two outstanding organizations, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and National Review. And, yes, I've been following every day, and when Andy does an entry on the corner or writes an article for National Review, and it's must reading for anyone following the goings on there. Andy, having tried some of the terrorists in the same Southern District of New York where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his alleged cohorts are heading, what are the main problems and pitfalls from a prosecutor's point of view?
Well, Roger, the biggest problem is trying to protect national security and the fact that your mission as a prosecutor runs contrary in important ways to your mission as an officer of the executive branch trying to protect national security information. On the one hand, as the prosecutor, your main job is to get these guys convicted, particularly in a national security case. If you have enough evidence to charge someone ethically, it's more important in those cases that the government prevail than in the normal case. So what your impulse is to indict the case broadly so that you can get every bit of admissible evidence in front of the jury. The downside to that is the broader you indict a case, the more discovery obligations you're buying onto. And that would be bad enough in, you know, just your normal run-of-the-mill case. But in a national security case, what it ends up meaning is that our very sensitive classified information, our national defense secrets, all become vulnerable to disclosure under the rules that apply. And beyond just the mere text of the rules, there's a rhythm of the trial which incentivizes all of the different players to maximize disclosure, to disclose more than the rules actually allow for, because the last thing you want to do in one of these cases, they're so lengthy and burdensome and dangerous and expensive, the last thing you want to have to do is do it a second time. So nobody wants it to be reversed. Most gets cases reversed is if a judge denies information to a defendant or the government withholds information from a defendant, or the Court of Appeals thinks that for whatever reason the defendant was not allowed to put his defense in at trial, which if you're going to be tried in civilian court, you have a constitutional right to do. So the national security mission and the prosecution mission really are at loggerheads in some important ways.
And what are a couple of examples of issues like, what, say, Project Bojinka, the identity of Osama bin Laden? What sort of things came up during your trial that would be relevant to this argument today?
Well, let's probably the best example is the Justice Department, because we don't want to have people convicted in the court of public opinion. You're not supposed to name people in charging instruments like indictments or arrest complaints unless you're ready to charge them. And that's why when you see government indictments, you frequently see people referred to as Conspirator A or Entity B or Corporation 1 rather than using the real names. That's pretty basic Justice Department rules, and I think it's a good rule. But what it means is that a defense lawyer, just looking at the charges, will not have enough information, particularly in a conspiracy case, to know who all the people the government alleges are in the conspiracy. You know, people who haven't been charged. So what happens in big conspiracy cases is the government is generally required to turn over what's known as a list of unindicted co-conspirators. That's the names of everybody who the government alleges may be a member of the conspiracy but who hasn't been charged. In a terrorism case, what that means is you end up having to give to the defense the identities of all kinds of people who are on the government's radar screen for investigative purposes but haven't been charged yet, either because the investigation against them isn't ripe, or you know they're bad guys but you don't have enough admissible evidence, or they're out of they're not in a position where you can physically get your hands on them to arrest them. There could be many reasons why you would not arrest somebody who would be a co-conspirator in a case. What happened in my case is we actually had to give a list like that over to the defense. It had the names of 200 people and entities on it. It's actually the first document produced by the government which went outside the government, to the defense lawyers in the case, that had Osama bin Laden's name on it. We didn't know a lot about him at the time. This was January of 1995, and I think what we knew was that he was a sort of a shady terrorist financier, but we didn't have a whole lot more information about him than that. But the important thing is we gave that list to the defense. Within a few days, it was in the hands of an al-Qaeda operative named Ali Mohammed, who later was involved in the bombing of the United States Embassy in Kenya. And he got it to Osama bin Laden's personal secretary, who got it to bin Laden himself in Sudan. So what that meant was very early on in our investigation, the head of al-Qaeda himself had a list of all the people that the government had under investigation who might be connected to the conspiracy, which, if you think about it, is a very valuable piece of intelligence for someone like bin Laden to have. You know, if you know you only communicate with a few people and yet you find out the government knows about you in a conspiratorial way, you have to figure maybe one of them is an informant. Maybe that phone I've been using is tapped. Maybe this room that I've been having meetings in has a bug in it. So you do all sorts of things to change your patterns, which may allow you to evade intelligence or evade surveillance that the government's been able to conduct, and you may kill people who you think may have compromised you as informants. So that's just one example, and be mindful of the fact that that's one thing that happened immediately prior to our trial. But the whole pretrial period is about mountains of discovery material, mountains of government intelligence, and then the trial itself is really an information banquet for people because witnesses have to come in and testify, and there's a lot of probing not only of intelligence itself but the methods and sources by which we gather intelligence.
So since Attorney General Eric Holder first announced this move a week ago, he had a press conference and he went on the Lehrer News Hour, and then yesterday he spent the day before the Senate, which certainly provided a lot of material and understanding. So one thing he said is that the New York is the venue most likely to obtain justice for the American people. How is he defending this move, and is he doing a good job at defending it?
Well, I don't think he's doing a very good job at defending it, but I don't think it can be defended. If you look at it, 11 months ago, in the military commission, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other four 9/11 plotters offered to plead guilty and proceed to execution. They actually wanted this to be at an end, and they were they were prepared to be executed at their military commission. I actually thought it was the first time in recorded history that the United States and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed could agree on something. You know, he wanted to be executed, and I think we should have accommodated him. But we didn't do that. The Obama administration came in and basically suspended all of the military commissions, which Obama as a candidate and Holder as one of his campaign spokespeople had pretty vigorously attacked during the campaign, along with the other Bush administration counterterrorism method. So they said they needed to study the military commissions, and as a result, we've had 11 months of delay, and now Holder has decided to send these guys to a civilian trial in New York. So I don't know how, you know, even if you believed it was important to do civilian trials for whatever policy reasons, how you could say with a straight face that you're more likely to get justice, more likely to get a conviction if you bring the case into civilian court, when in the military commission that we had 11 months ago, these guys were ready to plead guilty and be executed. I mean, what could have been a surer thing than that?
Yeah, one of the things you wrote this week is that of all the infuriating aspects of the decision to transfer them, the one that grates most is the contention that the Obama administration is finally moving forward after 8 years of delay, which is what Holder said at the press conference last week, a delay during which the Bush administration managed to complete only 3 military commission trials. Why did it take so long for the Bush administration to get these prosecutions?
Well, you know, the main reason it took so long is because leftist lawyers like Eric Holder and his firm, which represented 18 of the detainees, that is, they volunteered their services, gave their services for free to America's enemies during wartime, because lawyers like the lawyers at Holder's firm and a number of other lawyers flocked to Gitmo to get the clients among the detainees and then turned around and flooded the United States courts with habeas corpus petitions, basically trying to derail the military tribunals and derail the military commissions. That litigation was the main reason for delay over the last 8 years. They succeeded in 2006, after litigating this for a couple of years, they succeeded in 2006, Roger, in getting the liberal block of the Supreme Court, the five justices who tend to go left on these sorts of issues, they persuaded them to invalidate the military commission system in 2006. So even as we were on the verge of having some trials, those cases basically had to be started all over again because it took Congress a couple of months to come up with a new military commission system that would pass muster according to what the court had laid out in the 2006 Hamdan case. And then as soon as Congress enacted the military commission statute, the lawyers went back to federal court again and tried to get the military commission statute knocked out. And it took a couple of years to for that litigation to work its way through the system. So most of the delay was caused by the people now complaining about the delay. You know, the other couple of things that great as far as this is concerned is I don't know when Holder thinks we should have started trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He was arrested or apprehended, I should say, in wartime in Pakistan in 2003. We obviously, with somebody who had that stature in Al-Qaeda, we had to bring him in. We had to try to break him and get as much intelligence as we could from him. Given his position in Al-Qaeda, he was somebody who was absolutely incumbent on the government to try to extract every bit of intelligence that could be extracted from him in order to protect the American people, which, you know, ultimately we now know from his interrogations that they did have active mass murder plots that were underway. And if we hadn't conducted that interrogation, we wouldn't have known that. Even with all that, by 2006, they were ready to send him to Guantanamo Bay and give him a military commission. That was exactly when the left-wing lawyers were getting the Supreme Court to knock the military commissions that Bush had ordered out, and at the same time they were mounting their challenge to the new Military Commission Act. But still, we managed to get Khalid Sheikh Mohammed indicted or charged in a military commission case, and he was ready to plead guilty and be executed in only 2 years, 2008, and that didn't happen because the Obama administration then came in and pulled the plug on the commission. So, you know, I don't know when they thought he was going to be tried or what the delay is there. And the other thing I thought it was odd for Holder to complain about delay about was the Cole bombing. He said that, you know, it's been even longer that the families of the victims of the Cole bombing have had to wait for justice to be done. That was a rather odd thing for him to say, given that in October of 2000, when the Cole was bombed, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States was a guy by the name of Eric Holder. And, you know, the Department of Justice at that time did not file an indictment, didn't really do anything. Cole wasn't indicted until the Bush administration came in and until after 9/11 happened. And if we want to talk about, you know, justice delayed, if you go back to the Khobar Towers attack, in which 19 members of the United States Air Force were killed in 1996, that was also investigated on Holder's watch at the Clinton Justice Department, and they never filed charges on that one.
Mm-hmm. You brought up about where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was picked up in Pakistan, which kind of led to one of the more interesting moments yesterday, though I don't think it really got covered in the news much, but this was the exchange with Lindsey Graham, who asked Holder if there was a precedent for having captured a combatant on a battlefield and then trying him in civilian court. So what was Holder's response, and, you know, what is your opinion of it?
Well, Holder's response, we had to wait about 10 seconds for, Roger, because he was stumped. Senator Graham actually put the question to him, can you give me a case in United States history where an enemy combatant caught on a battlefield was tried in civilian court? And Holder had a long pause, and then he finally said, I don't know. I guess I'd have to look at that, I think. And then he sort of, his voice trailed off because he wasn't prepared to answer the question. And what I find, I must say, is that that is just mind-boggling because, you know, the stock in trade for lawyers is precedent. When you're setting a policy or when you have a policy question that comes up, if you're a lawyer, the first question you ask, the first order priority is, has this situation come up before? Are there prior cases on point? What have the courts said about this? That would be the first thing you would want to know. And, you know, Holder has said in recent days, as he's tried to explain himself here, that this was a decision that he considered very, very carefully for a long time, agonized over, analyzed at great length. How in the world can that be so if when the question comes, you know, has this ever been done before, which is basically the question that Graham asked him, he has to say, I don't know, because he didn't know what the precedents were. I just think that's very strange. That would have been the first question any lawyer would have asked.
Absolutely. So let's deal with a couple of the objections some people have raised. That number one, let's say that we've already successfully prosecuted more than 200 terrorists in this country, so why not these?
Well, you know, for one thing, I'd like to know who those 200 terrorists are. It'd be interesting to see what they're counting as a terrorism case. But, you know, the other thing that they're conflating here is litigation success and national security success. Whether a process is a success as far as the country is concerned is not wholly about whether somebody is convicted or not. I have no doubt, I was in these cases myself. I know the Southern District of New York. I spent 18 years in that office. The new U.S. attorney there who will be responsible for these cases is a guy who worked for me when he was a young prosecutor just starting out. I know he's an excellent, able lawyer. I fully expect that these guys will be convicted. Whether they're convicted or not is not the issue now any more than it was in the 1990s when we convicted 100% of the less than three dozen terrorists that we handled over a period of 8 years, and when the country nevertheless continued to be attacked by al-Qaeda in a more and more audacious way. The issue for national security purposes is how much of our national defense secrets do we have to turn over and expose to these guys in order to successfully prosecute them? Is there a way that we can do it better in the sense of better protecting our national security information? And are we returning to a 9-10, that is a September 10th sort of mentality, which, as just as it did in the 1990s, tells the enemy that we're going to try to fight bombs and mass murder attacks with subpoenas and indictments? Secretary Donald Rumsfeld famously said once that the weakness is provocative, and I think we learned that lesson to a fairly well in the 1990s. And if we're now suggesting to Al-Qaeda again that, you know, look, you conduct atrocious mass murders of civilians, and we're going to bring you into civilian court and give you all the majesty of the Bill of Rights that any American would get, and that's going to be how we respond to it, and we're somehow going to hope that that shows that we're so admirable that the hatred that these people bear against us is going to melt away, and the lion will lay down with the lamb, Al-Qaeda will lay down its bombs, and, we can all sing kumbaya. They're all crazy if they think that. And Al-Qaeda is going to look at this and say, this is the America we said was America all along. It's weak. It doesn't have a stomach for the fight. And if you make things bloody enough for them, they'll cower. And that's, that's the language that terrorists understand.
So there's others are pointing to a number of conservatives like Bob Barr and David Keene and Grover Norquist who are saying they are confident the government can preserve national security without resorting to sweeping and radical departures from an American constitutional tradition that has served us effectively for over two centuries. Well, what do you say?
I've debated Barr on these sorts of things. I'm shocked at how ignorant he is of American constitutional law and American history. You know, for somebody who runs around saying, that he's a former prosecutor and he really knows this stuff, he knows almost nothing. In the history of the United States, we've used military commissions going back to General Washington. It has never, ever, until this war, been the systematic practice in the United States that enemy combatants got access to civilian courts during wartime. That is the radical departure from American history. It's never been done. Doing it in this war in particular is even more dangerous and more silly than it would have been in prior wars, because in this war, rather than fighting a nation-state enemy, we're fighting a secretive transnational terrorist network that flouts the laws of war, that doesn't have a territory that we can attack, it doesn't have a treasury that we can seize to put them out of business. Basically, the only defense that we have, the only asset that we have in this kind of a war, this kind of an asymmetrical war, as they say in the military, is intelligence. We have to find out who the terrorists are, where they're hiding, what they're planning to hit next. You can't do that if you're going to turn this thing into a criminal justice issue, because why would anyone speak to you and give you intelligence if the first thing you're going to do when you bring them into the system is give them Miranda warnings?
We're unfortunately running out of time, but I want to get a couple of quick things in. Do you think the motive here, is this an effort to put Bush policies on trial, like the alleged torture and that sort of thing? What do you think is going on here?
I don't think there's any question that that's the main political reason which is driving this train. I don't think this was a legal decision at all. I think it was a political decision from the get-go, and the whole idea here is to give the left the reckoning that Obama and Holder promised them during the campaign by orchestrating this trial that doesn't have to happen, because we could have taken these guilty pleas 11 months ago. Basically, what you're going to have is the defense getting a couple of years to rifle through the government's intelligence files and then have a three-ring circus of a trial at which it puts the Bush administration on trial. That's what it's all about.
Do you think there's any way that it's true that Holder did not get Obama's approval before he made this decision or announcement?
No. I mean,
no.
I think they're being too clever here by half, and maybe they think they're fooling some people, but I doubt they're fooling many people. It may very well be literally true that Obama said Holder should make the call. But, Roger, think about the context in which that's happened. They've been discussing this for 10 months. Obama knows exactly where Holder is coming from on this. He knows where Secretary Gates is at. He knows the positions of all the players. if he, knowing that after 10 months, said he wanted Holder to make the decision, he obviously wanted Holder to make the decision because he knows what Holder's position is, and he wanted that to be the result.
Andy, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you so much for coming on. And, folks, next week we're going to be off for Thanksgiving. We'll be back in 2 weeks, so please come back to Take Aim, and have a great holiday.